use that as a as an example when developing that AICHG rubric committee.
Were these connections with Central Research at DuPont and Hercules in Wilmington, or were they with?
Yes, the arrangement at Hercules came because they invited me to a faculty visitation and complained about what we were doing in this area, and I told them the fault was theirs and how they could do something about it. And fortunately, Bob Cairns, who just died, was there, and he was high enough up to say, well, send us somebody next week and we'll change this. Well, that's one of the problems always, is that to deal with somebody who has the motivation and power to change things in the company. In the university, you can speak to an assistant professor and he doesn't mind complaining to the dean, but the young people hate to use up their goodwill
in industry,
asking the boss about something, the boss wonders, why are you concerning yourself with this?
Yeah. So Cairns was the one at Hercules. Was there a counterpart at DuPont who was very interested in this?
I'm sure of it.
I just wish to make one remark before we perhaps move on to the award. Publications earlier. You served on 27 committees, as well as being heavily involved in the AICHE and arranging with DuPont and Hercules for this program. And you apparently had a great interest in international chemical engineering. You visited quite a few countries.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wish that part of the record.
Well, after your term as AICHE president, you went back to Michigan in 67, and this is just about the time that you moved to Penn. I wonder if you could say a few things about your decision to leave Michigan and come to Penn.
Well, I was not unhappy at Michigan at that time. I was completing the first term as chairman, and I decided that I really preferred not to do administrative work. In fact, I was tossing around invitations to be considered for dean at several schools, Minnesota and several others. And one day, flying back to Minneapolis, I was on a plane and I thought, you know, that's not really what I like to do, it's to teach and do research. And although I had already turned down the position at Penn, they asked me again through a very fortuitous circumstance. And in the interim, I decided, well, maybe if I really want to do this, I'm going to have to get away from Michigan. I do not believe I can ever disengage from all the committees and administrative responsibilities I have here, even if I step down as chair. I was vice chairman of the University Senate there, and in countless things of this kind, you just never can disengage. And although I turned down Penn, I came to give the 75th anniversary lectures at Drexel that year, and there was an incredible snowstorm, and Drexel closed for the day, and the Penn people knew I was here, and Art Humphrey came down and said, why don't you come spend the day at Penn? And ultimately that led to my coming here. And I think what I said worked. I was always glad I made this move. I wrote very hard into the letters about coming that I would not serve on any committees or do any administrative things at all. That, I've not been able to maintain that position.
At least
it was some help in disengaging, simply moving disengagement from most things.
You mentioned that you came here in order to focus upon research and teaching. Could you tell us, please, about the nature of your research here during your early years at Penn? Was there continuity? Was there an essential continuity? You had worked previously upon convection, correlations, array processes, mathematical applications. What continuities were there? What discontinuities?
There was a great discontinuity. I had just gotten a large effort going on plasma chemistry in which we invested $500,000 at Michigan, and I couldn't take it with me. Really didn't take anything with me. So and lots of the things that I've been doing, I did not want to go through the effort of rebuilding the laboratory. The only continuity that I carried, I guess, was the numerical work, which didn't involve anything except one's head and a few computer programs, and I started the combustion work over again here. And I was fortunate when I first started the first year that I had about 4 graduate students started doing their work with me. If you look at my career at Penn, I've had proportionately far less graduate students here. During the late 60s and early 70s, there just weren't that many students here. So I probably would have preferred to have had as many as I had in Michigan, but that just was not fiscally or socially positive here. But that first array of graduate students, I guess, made it all worthwhile.
What was the size of your group in Michigan when you left?
Well, the year before, it would have probably been about 8 graduate students, which is more typical of chemistry, but very unusual in chemical engineering.
And when you did come, was it, you mentioned the classic chemistry work you had to leave behind, but in restarting the combustion work, what kind of sources of financial support did you find? Was it just, did Penn provide that as part of the package? Or?
Penn provided some, although not very much. We just did it with baling wire. I did not ask for, perhaps if I had asked for more, they would have given me more support. That was the fortunate timing, was that Penn had that Ford Foundation grant to make this a center of excellence in graduate work. And it was the support in chemical engineering, we diverted all that support to supporting students and attracting good students. And I had, even looking back, a marvelous array of students the first few years I was here. Joseph Chen and Romeo Manapaz and Hiroyuki Azoi and Eddie Hesman. And these students started very early with me. They made the transition very easy.
For the record, this Ford Foundation grant that you mentioned was awarded to the University of Pennsylvania the amount of $3 million for the expansion of its full-time graduate program in chemical engineering, leading to the PhD. And an effort was also undertaken at this time, around 1963, to recruit top-flight faculty for the department.
I believe that should be corrected. That grant was for all of engineering. I suspect that the $3 million was for all of engineering. And the other departments generally used it for equipment or something else.
Well, Kevin,
that was Art Humphrey's decision, and I think, and maybe Mark Hickson's, it was a very wise one.
In what way was Penn different from Michigan? It must have been a much smaller department than Michigan's, for starters.
It's different in many ways. But it's complicated because that also coincides with the Vietnam problem and all the disenchantment of students and all the disruptions of this kind. In fact, they were drafted and no student could really stay for graduate work for a while and so forth. So that at first I thought there were a lot of problems, but in retrospect, looking back, the same thing was happening at Michigan at the time. So although I was not overwhelmed with some aspects of this when I arrived, I think they had very little to do with Penn. We certainly had smaller classes, which was pleasant, but we really, actually, we had the same size classes at Michigan because we divided all the big groups up into small groups. I never had larger classes there than I did here.
So Michigan stopped having those enormous lectures that you spoke about when you were a student.
Yes, that was an impact in just 1947-48 of the returning veterans. No, they were not. We even in graduate classes, we broke up into 2 and 3 sections. Mm-hmm. If we had 100 graduate students, there would only be 30 in each class. So it was not such a... I found a lot of things difficult at Penn. We had much poorer machine shop facilities and things. It was very hard to get anything like this done. Michigan had a great supporting function because it was larger, and all these things, since you had to do yourself here. I did find one thing pleasant. There was less administrative superstructure at that time at Penn. I was very pleasantly impressed. There was the president and the vice president for engineering and the department chairman and yourself. And I had no hesitation in calling Gary Carnwell up any time, and he always would answer the phone and you could talk to him. Unfortunately, I think the reverse has happened in the meantime. And when Martin Morrison was here, he added echelons and echelons of administration.
Before we get too far from our discussion of your research, you mentioned that one of the discontinuities was to reinitiate research into combustion. Now, can you tell us about when you began doing that here at Penn and why?
I had been working on that problem unsuccessfully at Michigan. One of my latter doctoral students at Michigan, Tom Bath, tried to study a process I thought was feasible, namely burning in a refractory tube. And he succeeded, but he could never do this without braiding a tube. In the interim, in consulting for Marathon Oil, I discovered that they had some furnaces which it looked like would do that work, and I indeed succeeded in getting them to give us a box of these furnace elements, and it was that that got Joseph Chen's combustion work off and running. So we got started on that pretty rapidly after I came here. I can't speak in weeks or months, but he began right away.
I think the Chen articles that you're speaking of, were these the ones that were published in 72?
Yes.
Stabilization of flames and refractory tubes and a theoretical model for stable combustion inside a refractory tube.
Those were very important articles, and both the one theoretical and the other experimental. Mm-hmm. Joseph Chen probably started that in 67, mm-hmm. quite shortly after I came. Then Jay Gupta came along and worked on a problem which came out of my consulting for Conch. We were designing underground storage tanks. We had no idea at all of rates of heat transfer through the ground with freezing. So Jay agreed to make measurements of this kind and did experimental work on that kind. And we found some remarkable things that we didn't expect about water migration from that. Although that's not work that had particularly continued. We never gained support for it. And
Could you tell us a bit about these people you worked with? You mentioned Chen, you mentioned Gupta. I noticed you published extensively Hiroyuki Ozo.
Ozoe,
with Sayamara, with Yamamoto, with Paul Chiao, and Naomi Lior. Could you tell us a bit about these people, your interactions with them, what research you worked on with them, and their effect upon your work, your effect upon their work, and things like that?
Hiroyuki Ozoe, I've done more work than with any other human being, and he did his doctoral work with me on natural convection, following up work that had been done at Michigan. And he did both experimental and theoretical work. And we continued to do this work jointly when he went back to Japan to teach. And he was in a position in a Japanese university locked into a system where he still to this day is not allowed to have doctoral students. So he and I have continued to interact, and I do things here and he does things there, but he has had better access to computers than I have, so often he's done the theoretical work there, we've done experimental work here, although it's reversed. And then I spent 4 months in Japan working with him in 1977, and in 1979, and again in 1984, we spent extended periods here. And so my students worked with my students, and this has been a remarkable instance of work. We write to each other to this day 3 and 4 letters a week. Our basic hesitate when I have a thought about something, I just dash off a 3-sentence letter and put it in the mail. He does this. So that way it's almost as if he were in the next.
This has been a remarkably productive relationship.
Yes.
Just for the record, you and he have co-authored 33 articles, 16 alone in the last 5 years.
And so, well, that's been productive. Paul Chow, who's a much later student, continued and improved upon some of the things that Hiroyuki Mizoi was doing, and so he, in a sense, was drawn into that network also. He did remarkable in that he did theoretical work, experimental work, and also stood the computer science department in the head by developing a method of displaying all of these computations live on a cathode ray tube in the laboratory. We still have some interaction. He's working for Mobile now, has been for the last 5 years. Paul Chow's father is head of the cement business in Taiwan. He gave me a hard time because I did not encourage Paul enough to enter academic work. But Paul's wife works for the university, and they really want to live. She has a very good job, and they want to stay in Philadelphia. That is, in a sense, made. There's not the university in the Philadelphia area where Paul has wanted to work. So, Jay Gupta, one of my early students, went back to India and is taught there. But he too has visited regularly at Penn for summers, I think. So we have continued to interact. Year. He just has published a very, I think, going to be a very important book on heat transfer.
In looking over the list of your students since you've been at Penn, it strikes me that, well, the ones we've just heard of, Japanese, Taiwan, Indian, is this international flow of students characteristic of chemical engineering in the last 20 years?
There are two effects of this. One, during the period of 1967 to 72 or so, it was impossible to be deferred and therefore go to graduate school unless you were had a physical disability or were a foreign student. So all of that students at that time got PhDs. One was from Taiwan, one from Japan, one from Philippines, and so forth, and the other two, and one from Korea. The one exception, all that, I guess, Mel Bernstein and Aaron Wiener both had physical disabilities that prevented them in military service. So it had that impact. And at one time, about 5 years ago, more than half of the graduate students in PhDs in chemical engineering in the United States were foreign students. This is because it has not been a particularly attractive thing to do for most American students. There were no jobs in teaching for a while, and the industry said they didn't want PhDs, and so that market went way down. We have been counter to that. Penn has almost no foreign students now, really, chemical engineering. We must be 90%, well, we have three students from University College Dublin, we have a French student, we have almost no Oriental and Chinese students, Oriental students, I should say. And you could fill any graduate school with such students. There's a large crop that would like to come to the United States because they see no opportunity in their own. Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting, not an irony, this trend is interesting in light of the fact that in the late 19th century, American students went abroad for training in science and engineering, and now, certainly since the war,
students were teaching in many countries in the world. One of them went back to the Philippines, although he disappeared in the Philippine Revolution. I don't know if Romeo Lamba caused, but what happened to him?
Let me just ask you again a few more things about the differences between Penn and Michigan, if we could. You mentioned the difference in administrative structure and administrative responsibilities, something about the size of the department and the graduate student body. How about computer availability, since that was one of the leitmotifs we were in Michigan?
We probably had one of the two or three best computer facilities in the country at University of Michigan, and one of the worst among the top 100 schools at Penn, and that has consistently remained so. And we have, my work has continued in this field despite the poor computing facilities and access to them at Penn, and it's hard to say why this has happened, but it has happened.
In what ways did that frustrate your work in the late 60s and early 70s?
Well, it frustrated because we had to do things harder ways than other people. We were using poor class by generation computers always than other people. I think it has had some good effects too. The pressure to do just as well with poor facilities has perhaps honed us a little bit.
Did it lead to more mathematically elegant solutions, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I just think we have had to be more clever. I really think it has had, if you have infinite computer facilities, you'd be very careless.
Sure.
You really have to look at this, and you have this much money, what can you get out of it? You become very careful. So I think it has had some positive advantage. There's another thing I'd like to say about the difference in Penn and Michigan that's not favorable. This is that Michigan was one large community of scholars. I knew everybody in sociology and history and math and physics and chemistry, and of course in engineering. When I came to Penn, I went into a state of shock that nobody in chemical engineering talked to anybody outside of chemical engineering. This was just the absolute thing, and outside of engineering, no one did this. It has changed almost entirely for the better during this period, although it still is a very highly structured and non-collegial place, in my view, partly because people don't live together, and that provides a great disruption. And somehow the faculty club is now a mixing place, whereas it was at Michigan. People, they had long tables, and all the faculty sat down together, irregardless of department. And so we got to know people. And I think it was very beneficial science-wise. I would know the chemistry, physics, or math. When I had a problem, it was easy to call.
Well, it also showed up in your writing while you were at Michigan. You must be one of the few chemical engineers to ever quote Aristotle and Mark Twain and Bacon and a number of others in your writing.
If I may return just a short while to some of your research here. And one thing that impresses me reading the papers that you've written is your remarkable ability to pose a problem, to find something, to do something experimentally, and then to come right back and in the same article or in an associate article propose some sort of theoretical model or solution. You have this ability to wed, as it were, experimentation and theory. And this was, I think, comes out very clearly in those two papers we mentioned in 72 that you collaborated upon with Chen. You also indicated as among the more important of your works, the articles that were published in 1983, one being Free Convection Around Immersed Bodies, Free Convection in Waves and Enclosures. Also another one, Combined Free and Forced Convection around Immersed Bodies, and Combined Free and Forced Convection in Channels. And I see that too there, this wedding of the experiential and the theoretical. Would you care to comment a bit about that, and also about these latter four articles I just mentioned, what their importance is?
Yeah, I have two different comments. On the first, I think it's because I've always taken the objective of saying that we would do something theoretical and then we would run a critical experiment to make sure we had the right model. So all the students have always known they had to do both of those things, and I think with one or perhaps two exceptions, every single student of mine has always done both theoretical and experimental work. I've forgotten once a chemist told me this. It came as a great shock to see this in my papers, because no chemist would ever do both. He was either theorist or experimentalist. And I guess maybe because philosophically I thought that should be done, I've always had that orientation, so we just automatically do this. And my students, when I talk to them before they ever decide to do research with me, know they're going to do this. There's been an interaction between those two. Curiously, in Joseph Chen's work, which is a remarkable thing maybe in all of science, that He had done experimental work first and then succeeded in getting a computer to model blind because he had no experience in doing computing ever, and we had very poor facilities, and I didn't think anything was going to come of it. And all of a sudden, he burst out with a great theoretical result, which said that there were seven stationary states in combustion, which nobody believed until we went and measured them. This was just out of the blue, and he had not found that experimental. He thought that the irreproducibility was an experimental work. And I think that that's again an instance for the complementary nature of these things. The next student came along and found all those solutions. So I think that that does show up in my work, and it is characteristic, and I have infected all the other students, and Azoi and Choi and all those people who came to continue independent work to do just that. That may not be appropriate in all fields, in thermodynamics or some areas, but I think in the transport area, you never know whether the model is right or not. You made it two-dimensional. Is the behavior really two-dimensional? We become very clever, I think, in identifying critical experiments. That's how I characterize the students, what I do. We try to model some phenomena, and then we try to think of a critical experiment that will test very yes or no model. And that relates, however, to this other set of papers. Back in, I would guess, 1972, I guess, I had an idea. I was trying to correlate data, and I realized that often one knew the asymptotic behavior, and this ought to be incorporated in correlations. And as a general rule, up to that time, people always tackled correlation independent of any theory or using some theory. And I found this works almost infallibly in all things. If you can find two asymptotes, you never have any trouble correlating the data very precisely. Now, of course, what that leads you to do is to get to devise and think about asymptotic behavior and asymptotic solutions. And so I may have written more papers on that than any other
thing. With my counterpart, Sati?
Aryu Sagi,
yes.
Aryu Sagi is a non-real person. This is my wife's professional guitar playing name, and so that's the source of that.
Well, I'm looking right here at perhaps this very same article you're mentioning, a general expression for the correlation of rates of transfer and other phenomena. It says, with R. Usagi. Yes. Please explain what this is all about.
she's always been interested in Japanese, and she used that name as a professional name because she was working for the AICHG and also playing guitar, and she didn't want to associate the two. Usagi means rabbit in Japanese.
Okay.
And R is her initial.
Right.
So she was worked with me on the first of that correlation. But I have done quite a bit of work correlating not only my data but many other sets of data. And those three handbook articles, I started on one and then they asked me to do two and three, so I used that model to reassemble all the data for natural convection.
And that word seems, in a way, of a piece with your rate data, which came out in 74, and then, it's the same kind of approach that we've seen from the late 50s on in your research.
Yeah, it fits in very well with it. Actually, I left it out of the book, and Bob Cedar, who reviewed the book, said, why did you leave that out? And I said, I just haven't digested that. It came out at the same time, and I didn't want to put it in half-baked. And he said, I'm going to tell McGraw-Hill, don't publish the book unless you put that in. So it is in a very early version of that book. First, I was in Houston Saturday and Sunday giving a two-day course on telling people how to use that technique for correlation.
So that's the 74 book, and then this technique presumably has some impact in the last 10 to 12 years.
Well, I think so. I think in the long run, that will have the most impact of anything that I've done. It may not be very profound, but I think it is so incredibly useful. And it also happens to fit very well with computers, because no one wants graphical correlations anymore or tabulations, and this gives you a simple equation you can use for summarizing data using it for design. So that's and it also relates to an earlier paper, which I would think is of equal importance maybe. That was the Helms paper on mathematical simplification of boundary value problems. That technique is, as far as I know, the first one which reduces all partial differential equations to ordinary ones. If it can be done, if it can't be done, it tells you. So this is a great clean-cut thing. And why this was always overlooked by mathematicians, I have no knowledge. Birkhoff at Harvard did something related to this, but nobody ever reduced this to a practical...
I suppose it's because the mathematicians didn't have to worry about the practical implications.
They weren't interested in doing this. But it always bothered me, I guess, all my career. I'm not very good when people say it's obvious that, or if you... It really bugged me that people would say, if you let z equal y squared over x is reduced to an ordinary differential equation. And I kept asking myself, why? And I finally asked it with David Helms in the right way. And we sat down and we went through a very exciting week in which every day we both had a new idea, in which we said, well, if we leave the decision to the last minute, we'll do this in a very general way, and we leave the decision, we ought to just be able to see what to do. And sure enough, that pops up. And so...
The paper to which you are referring is entitled Simplification of the Mathematical Description of Boundary and Initial Value.